Let me go every morning for over a month, except for when I was in Thailand.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Thank you very much for being here. We have three House bills that have been referred to us that we have scheduled for public hearings today. I'll first say that Senator Denborough will be here. Unfortunately, got caught up in traffic coming down from Portland. So I believe what we're going to do is go through the House bills in the order that they're on the agenda. And with that, I'll go ahead and open up the first of the public hearings for House Bill 4082A. And that is Chana.
Chair Pisanski, members of the committee. Of, excuse me, 4082?
Yeah, 48.
That is Whitney. Pardon me.
I'm sorry, Chair Brzezinski, could we actually do that one last? Representative Peluso is testifying in another committee and wanted to be able to
come out and testify. All right, so we'll recess on 4082A, and we're going to now go to House Bill 4087A as a public hearing. Chana.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Members of the committee, we have 4087A, which came to you from the House Business and Labor Committee. It passed unanimously out of that committee and with 56 aye votes across the House floor. It deals with mechanics liens. It allows an auto repair shop to certain current law allows an auto repair shop to certain against a vehicle repaired until the owner settles payment for the services rendered. House Bill 4087 requires auto repair shops to carry a bond of at least $20,000 in order to properly attach a lien on a repaired vehicle.
All right, thank you. I know we have Representative Evans. Why don't you come on up? And I have three other people. Is Aaron here? Aaron, why don't you go ahead and come on up and you can maybe, or did you want to do the closing?
I'll close.
Okay. Thank you. Representative?
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I am Paul Evans. I represent House District 20. It's nice to see everybody here and the two newest faces, although Representative Bence, I kept looking over in the House floor and you're not there and it feels kind of weird, but I'm glad that you're here. So House Bill 4087A is a committee bill that was a product of a work group that actually did the improbable. I understand that there's a small legal glitch that needs to be fixed to make sure that that is the truth. But the intent of this was actually to find a real solution to a legitimate problem that didn't involve a whole lot of bureaucracy, didn't involve a whole lot of enforcement mechanisms, and basically helped the vehicle repair shops of good character to not have to do more than they're already doing, and the folks that are, shall we say, less of good character and charging people for work they don't do and charging for things that they do badly, to not give them the same access to a tool that some people have been using inappropriately. I want to say, first of all, thank you to Jan Nordland, Cheryl Hemstra, Daryl Fuller, John Geer, and a number of other folks, especially Representative Holvey, who allowed this to be a committee bill. It really is a way to ensure that if you want to use a bond, if you want to actually use the lien, you have to have proof that you can pay penalties if you actually are found to do something you shouldn't be doing. Right now, there are a number of organizations, number of shops that use this lien that don't necessarily perform the work, and in some cases perform it so badly that the cost and the expense that is attached to the lien is greater than the cost of the car. And this is one of the ways we thought was a simple, straightforward approach. It was not what anybody loves, but it's what everybody can live with, and I think it's an example of a good first step. I do want to inform the committee that we plan on continuing to work. There are a couple of side issues that were realized through the committee process that we hope to actually use this as a foundation block to continue working to try to make sure that the folks that are doing the right things aren't penalized and the folks that are doing the wrong things find another line of work. That's basically the approach.
All right. Thank you, Representative Evans. Any questions for the representative? Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you
very much. I'm going to go ahead and call up the next two individuals, Daryl Fuller and John Geer. And while they're getting situated, is there anyone else besides Aaron Knott who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 4087A? Daryl or John, whoever.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Geer. I'm a consumer attorney here in Salem, and I'm well aware of the problem that this bill addresses because I have a number of worthless judgments against repair shops that pretty blatantly and flagrantly ripped off consumers in auto repair. One of the top 10 consumer complaints to the Oregon Department of Justice Consumer Protection Hotline is about shady repair shops. Most repair shops are not shady. Most repair shops are very good and very equitable, but all repair shops have a very powerful lien, a very powerful weapon against being cheated by consumers. I mean, the mechanics lien is old as history, and if a consumer drops off their vehicle at a repair shop, the repair shop immediately has a possessory lien or the ability to assert a possessory lien and keep the consumer from getting their vehicle back without paying the charges assessed. And that's fine. The problem is when the playing field is not level and when the repair shop is not dealing on the up and up, the repair shop has the lien and the consumer may have nothing. And when you end up suing them and getting a judgment against them and they turn out to be worthless and have no assets, you've been hit twice. You had to pay this lien to get your vehicle back, or you've lost your vehicle, and then you have a worthless recovery. So the bond is not a perfect, it's not the ideal regulatory system, but it's a very light touch regulatory system that says, if you want to use this weapon that we give you, this mechanics lien, you also have to be able to pay a judgment if you were the shady side. I could say lots more, but it's a short session. I don't want to fill it all up. I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone has.
All right, let's take testimony from Daryl, and then we'll open it up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller here on behalf of two different clients, the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association, that represents small independent dealers, some of whom also repair vehicles, and the Northwest Auto Trades Association, which is the association that represents both collision and mechanical repair shops. First, I want to say both organizations are strongly in favor of Friday. I'm very excited it's Friday. In addition to that, I don't want to sort of parrot anything that's already been said so eloquently by Mr. Gear or Representative Evans. So I will simply refer you to testimony on OLIS from both of my clients. It's there. It's a beautiful prose. It's a great read this evening before you go to bed if you're looking for something to do. And then I would finally point out that this is a voluntary bond. A repair shop is not required to have the bond in order to be a repair shop. They only have to buy the bond if they're going to use the lien process to take possession of a vehicle for a consumer that hasn't paid their bill. Now, if the consumer hasn't paid their bill, the dealer doesn't have the bond, they would have to release the vehicle to the consumer, but they could still sue the consumer to recover what the consumer owes them. They simply wouldn't be able to keep the vehicle as leverage. So this is a voluntary bond only if the repair shop wants to use the mechanics lien as leverage against a consumer who hasn't paid his bill. And again, we provide lots of information if it's necessary, but I'm just happy to answer any questions that you have.
All right, thank you. Questions for either Senator Thatcher first.
How do the liens get exercised? They just send a notice to the consumer, or they just say, I'm gonna be keeping your car until you pay up?
I'll defer to Mr. Gear, who's an attorney, and will know more about that process than I do.
Senator Thatcher, Mr. Chair, there's a process for asserting the lien. You have to register. There's a couple of commercial lien services that you file the lien and you assert it. It's actually what you do is you have the lien the minute the car is left with you. You can assert the right to foreclose on the lien and sell the car to recover the bill by going through and filing, and it's a statutory process, and I should know that number, but I don't.
Maybe redirect it to a little bit. So what does the consumer see? How do they get notice that there's a lien?
The filing of the lien has to be, the notice has to be sent to the consumer by the person when they try to foreclose the lien.
Which is the consumer, which is the service that?
Yes, normally the shops use the service.
Mr. Chair, normally when the person comes in to get their repairs done, you sign something that says that you're basically authorizing them to do the work. And in the fine print is where they talk about having the mechanics lien. And so many people don't realize that as Mr. Gear stated, once you take your car in to fill and you say, oh, yeah, I'll go ahead and fix it, if you don't pay, they hold on to it. So if you could just follow up, John, and just tell us a little bit more as to that procedure, I mean, it would seem like if the person comes to pick up their car and they go, wait a second, I'm going to pay $10,000 to fix this car. At that point, they're not going to release the car to them, correct?
Mr. Chair, correct. That's exactly right. And further, the vehicle repair shops we're talking about are not the reputable shops. We're talking about the ones who are in a rented space or in even garages can be legal repair shops. There's no regulation of auto repair in Oregon. So if your fella down the street working out of his garage says, yeah, bring it in, I'll do your brakes, and you go in and you notice that there's brake fluid all over the floor and that you touch the pedal and it goes right to the floor, you say, wait a minute, you didn't do that, you didn't do anything. That guy can still assert a lien, even though he's violated the requirement to have a written estimate. Mm. So it may not, there may be no paper at all. And you sometimes have cars that are towed into a repair shop, and then the repair shop says, well, we had to take this apart to do the damage estimate. That's work, and that is included in the mechanic's lien. If you strip down a car to look at it and estimate repairs, that is work for which you can be paid and assert a lien. So there may be no signature to the consumer until they're told, pay up or we're going to sell your car.
Right, Senator Thatcher.
I guess what I'm getting at is how would a consumer know it's a legitimate lien? If they're a shady business, they're a shady business. They might still have the same paperwork that says in the small print, here's a lien potential for you as you're getting this car repaired, and then they get served a lien. They don't know that it's that this person doesn't have a bond. So what mechanism is there for a consumer to verify that it's a legitimate lien?
That's when they have found an attorney, and the attorney can say, where's your bond to the shop? You know, you asserted a lien. You didn't give my client their vehicle when she demanded it. Where's your bond? You asserted a lien. Give me the name and the number of your bond. And if they didn't have that bond, then there's a claim.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, following up on Mr. Gere's comments, when consumers' cars are held and they're trying to figure out what to do next, prior to this bill, they basically had three different avenues that consumers generally would go through to get help. One would be to complain to DMV, and DMV has helped resolve a number of these cases. The other would be to complain to the Department of Justice Consumer Protection Division, and the third would be to talk to a private attorney. And obviously all three of those avenues would be aware of this law, and a simple phone call to the repair shop saying, do you have the bond required to do this? And if they don't, they have to surrender the keys.
All right, so just follow up on that. There's no place in the sense of an agency that actually would have these records within their jurisdiction, I guess I'm going to say, like CCV for construction contractors. They have a bond, and you can go online and do all that. But there's nothing like that for
Mr. Chair. The answer to that is no. DCBS, Department of Justice, DMV were all at the table in the work group that created this. None of them were willing to put their hand up and say, yes, we want to regulate this industry. They all think it's a really good idea, but nobody wanted to bear the burden of the cost of the regulation. And there was a concern about if we went that route, it would price up the bill to the point that we couldn't get the consumer protection we're trying to get out of the $20,000 bond. So as Representative Evans indicated, this group is interested in continuing to sit together and see if there aren't other things, because the reputable repair shops, right, are as interested in getting rid of the bad guys as the consumer lawyers are. We don't like them either. They make us look bad. But what we don't want to do, like with most small business associations, we don't want the cost of being the good guy to be so high, right, that it makes it easier for people to go to the bad guys, because we're paying a lot of regulatory oversight. And so it's trying to find that sweet spot, and we think this is a good first step.
Okay. Any other questions based on our discussion? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Aaron, why don't you go ahead and come on up?
J- Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General of the Oregon Department of Justice here in support of House Bill 4087. I was not actually the attorney who sat on this particular work group. That was Cheryl Heemstra, who is out today after the various adventures of yesterday. She needed a break, and I don't blame her. But she did authorize for me to testify with the assurance that any difficult technical or legal questions that are raised by this committee during this hearing should be routed directly to Daryl Fuller. So in all seriousness, however, this is an area of significant consumer abuse for the Oregon Department of Justice. In 2017, we received over 280 complaints of vehicle repairers alleging I didn't receive the service that I asked for, or my car was essentially held hostage by fees that I didn't anticipate. I didn't feel like I received all the disclosures that I needed. And while I'm far from an expert in this area, I do understand the basic DOJ framework to be, you know, if you get a misrepresentation about the work that's going to be done on a vehicle, sometimes we can take action, especially if it's being done often enough to create a pattern or practice of a harm. But that part of what this is trying to fix is that there are actually ways that you can lawfully, under existing law, sort of sneak in terms into the fine print that, you know, aren't misleading but lead to a very misleading outcome. So Cheryl lets me know that the process here was very good, very collaborative, and probably not totally done, that this conversation will move forward into the interim, but this is a good bill on its own merit, and we do support it. So I'm open for any question I can punt to somebody else.
All right. So I don't see anyone raising their hand, so I think you're free to take off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. So that concludes our public hearing. I understand we're going to do a little tightening down on the language, and I also understand that there will be continued work with a work group during the interim. One of the things I would ask the work group to consider is whether or not, and Daryl, this is probably more for you, your association, would there be some means to have your association having some type of record inventory on the liens that have been filed? In other words, have your members actually have some notation, and we could have something more centrally located where people could contact and say, does this place have a bond? So I don't know if that works or not, but if you can throw that in the hopper, that'd be great. With that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 4087A. And we're going to go ahead and go with House Bill, open up a public hearing on House Bill 4082A.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. This is House Bill 4082A and was brought to you by Representative Peluso. House Bill 4082A directs the Oregon Youth Authority to administer the Juvenile Justice Information System in partnership with county juvenile departments through a steering committee. It also allows disclosure of certain juvenile records to a government agency, public or private post-secondary educational institution, or a person with whom OYA, a county, or a county juvenile department has entered into an agreement for disclosure for certain purposes such as program planning. It also specifies that the persons who receive these records are responsible for preserving their confidentiality. There are no amendments, and the 4082A has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
All right, thank you. Representative Bullock.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee. For the record, I am Carla Peluso, proudly representing House District 50, hailing to you from the great city of Gresham. As you know, leaders in the Oregon Youth Authority and our county juvenile departments are committed to evidence-based practices, data-informed decisions, and developing programs that improve public safety. All of these efforts depend on sound research and evaluation, as well as external validation of their data tools and practices. Recently, the Youth Authority became aware that the state law was silent on the practice of sharing data for the purpose of research and evaluation. Silence puts the practice of sharing data in legal jeopardy. House Bill 4082 is a fix to this issue. It puts in law that data can be shared for the purpose of research and evaluation. Sometimes we as legislators have an opportunity to make a small change in a law that has a big positive impact. This is such a bill. I encourage you to join me in supporting House Bill 4082 and to continue to support the Youth Authority and County Juvenile Departments in using research and evaluation to evolve and focus their practices on the public safety outcomes we all want them to achieve. If you have any questions, Christine Kirk is here in the back. And other than that, I just thank you for your consideration of House Bill 4082.
All right. Any questions for the rep? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to go ahead and call up Christine and Joe Ferguson.
Hi.
Good morning.
Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, my name is Christine Kirk. I'm the acting deputy director for the Oregon Youth Authority. First, I would really like to thank Representative Peluso for carrying this bill. When we realized that there was a glitch in our current practice of sharing data for the purposes of research and evaluation, she was of great help in helping create a bill for this short session, and I'm very, very thankful. I believe that Representative Peluso covered most of the key facts in terms of why we're here. Hopefully the why, in terms of realizing that our current practice may not be legal and our stopping doing research, conveys why there's an emergency clause to this bill. It's so that we can continue doing research. In some cases, we halted the creation of contracts. We didn't release data that we had previously agreed to, so there are many things that are in hanging out there, and that is why there's an emergency clause. One of the things that we took an advantage of with this bill was to work with our county partners and ask the question, does the current law articulate the partnership? And as we looked at it, it does not. And we have a very strong partnership in how we work together. And so we also took the opportunity to put in law how things actually work, and that we manage the juvenile justice information system and all of the data that we get collaboratively. Most of the data is entered by the county juvenile departments, and most of the youth never come to the Oregon Youth Authority. So that partnership is really important, because we're all entering data, and there has to be trust as well as kind of common language and how we use the data system. The other thing that this allowed us to do is maintain confidentiality on the data that we do release. While the data sets are de-identified, it is important that the data remain confidential for that particular research purpose, and so this law clarifies that also. So I think that we've gotten a couple wins out of the opportunity that at one point was rather stressful to be facing. I do need to mention on the record one clarification. In the amendment that went through the House, we added who we can contract with or develop an agreement with. Quite often, we are developing agreements with higher education institutions to perform research for us, or they have research that they are doing that relates to the juvenile justice system and may ask us for data, and we develop data sharing agreements. The higher education folks raised for us that they would like clarification, because in putting them in the bill, it didn't all of a sudden mean that they have greater access to the data that we have. So I want to clarify that our intention is for the data to be disclosed to the recipients of an MOU or a contract for the specific purpose as outlined by law, administrative rule, and articulated in those memorandums. The agreements that we create are very limited in scope. They have prohibitions in terms of how the data can be used and not releasing it to other people. And in some cases where it's being used for a specific paper, there are destruction cycles that are tied to the data. The proposed law change does not impose any additional obligations or expectations on public or private colleges or universities to access data. Information accessible to the institutions is limited to the agreements I just spoke to, and in no way can be used for any other purpose. And within rule and our current policies, we will define more clearly that the purposes are tied to the benefit of the juvenile justice system, the programs that we have, or in the individual outcomes of youth in those programs. That's all that I have, and I'd like to welcome my partner, Joe Ferguson, to talk about this from a county perspective.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Prozanski and members of the committee, my name is Joe Ferguson. I wear two hats today, one as the current president of the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, and the other is a JJIS Steering Committee member. We asked for support, of course, of this bill. You know, this really codifies the 20-year partnership and collaboration between the county juvenile departments and the Oregon Youth Authority since the inception of JAGES. This also strengthens the ability to continue to do research and program evaluation and audits that leads to better overall outcomes of youth that we serve throughout Oregon. Also, this enhances a statewide system that very few other states have, and we're really seen as a national model in terms of having a statewide one youth, one record system. And this continues to be able to provide that research to continue to build those programs in terms of what's most effective for youth through evidence-based, through research, through assessments. And so we asked both through the Oregon Juvenile Parent Directors Association and through the steering committee that you support this bill.
All right. Questions for the panel? And Joe, I'll just start off just for the record. Which county are you director at?
Jackson.
Jackson. Great. Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and ask Mary and Aaron to please come up. And while they're coming up, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on House Bill 4082A?
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sophia. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I am also here essentially as a practitioner. So I myself personally represented hundreds of juveniles while I practiced law. And the 1,300 members of my organization, many of them represent juveniles. This matter was incredibly important to my legislative committee when we sat down to talk about it. We were incredibly happy to be tagged by Rep. Peluso to come support the bill. Our understanding was that this information had been shared for a very long time, and a lot of the information and data that was gathered and analyzed and provided is incredibly important to the well-being of the state of Oregon. The juvenile justice information system is a way for outcomes essentially to be better, and so we support it. I think one of the important pieces for us is making sure that the law is actually being followed and that the information is there so that we can continue doing this good work, and we support it. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Aaron?
All right. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, again, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice, also here in support of House Bill 4082. Any commitment to a data-driven criminal justice system is necessarily going to require us to actually study the data. It's sort of hard-cooked into the definition. But in our urge to make that very intelligent, necessary study, we cannot lose sight of the fact that this data, especially when we're talking about our kids, is inherently sensitive. And so the interest of the Department of Justice in 4082 was in making sure we built real strong sideboards around how this data could be shared to make sure it wasn't used for any purpose other than research, aggregated and appropriate for drawing system-level conclusions about our juvenile justice system. And in that light, I want to commend Representative Peluso and OIA for their partnership in really helping make this the most privacy-protective bill they could. I think we accomplished that. A couple aspects of this I do want to get into the record. The basic structure here is it just lays out a confidentiality framework that makes clear how you can use this data. You know, that privacy laws generally governing transmission of data will apply here, except within caveats laid out within the bill. It also takes the intelligent step of making very clear what type of entity can receive this data, government broadly defined, whether state and local, as you heard already, an institute of higher education, or a person with whom OIA has entered into a specific agreement for research. And that's meant to sweep in your nonprofits, your research institutions, but to do so within the framework of a formal agreement. So this is a bill that had a bit of a journey in the first chamber, but ended up in a very good place, and I am happy to support it and open for any questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the panel? Senator Lethicombe.
Mr. Knott, when you describe the entering into agreement with those nonprofits or what, in the language subsection for a government allowable parties, a government agency, post-secondary institution, youth authority, county juvenile department has entered into agreement with disclosure, et cetera, Are those other post-secondary and government agencies also entering into agreements? This entering into agreement clause is only in section subsection C of that clause. And the language for entering into agreement with regard to the youth authority does not exist under those other agencies.
And Chair Przanski, Senator Lithicum, that might actually be a good question for OIA. As you've heard, that there has been previous work done in this area in terms of structuring agreements with higher education, and I know they can give a more precise answer than I can. So with the leave of the chair, I might try to route that to them.
Okay. We'll throw a lifeline out there.
Sure. It's there.
Hello, Christine Kirk, Acting Deputy Director for the Oregon Youth Authority. So if I understand the question, you're trying to make sure that as we contract with entities that in each case we would have that agreement?
Yes.
Yes. Our existing past practice, I should say, is that we never release data without an agreement. Depending on the type of agreement, it changes whether it is an MOU, which may be when there's no money transferred between a university and ourselves, or a contract when we are contracting for our actual evaluation services. As part of this process, we will be reviewing the confidentiality provisions that are in there to make sure that they're consistent, and also with the rule that we will develop to further clarify it so that they all support one another, and also working with our county partners to make sure that there's some consistency in how we articulate the confidentiality and not using the data for any other purpose.
I might suggest that language has entered into agreement for disclosure of information under this subsection belongs in small letters sub A, where we're describing that agreement requirement is for all three types of agencies, a government agency, a post-secondary institution, youth authority, county juvenile departments, et cetera, that they're all operating under a rule. Mm-hmm. Which sounds like it's the rules in place, but the only statutory requirements on the lowest level. Thoughts?
I don't have a problem.
All right. Any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you all very much. All right. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 4082A. And Chana, can you give us Whitney, can you give us the perspective on the bill itself, ready to go?
Yes, thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. That's correct. The 4082A version is ready to go, and it has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact, and there are currently no amendments pending.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and open up I guess I should first close the work session on 4082A, open a work session on 4082A. Did I say that backwards?
Close the public hearing.
Close the public hearing. Open work session. It is Friday. Good thing it is. Yeah.
I just said that twice. Did I vote for that bill?
Yes.
Friday.
All right. So, Chair will take a motion on 4082A.
Okay. Mr. Chair, move House Bill 4082A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 4082A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Other than, you know, the issue I was pointing out, I'm fine with it. There's legalese there that may or may not, you know, circle back around. So, but in general, I agree with the principles, sharing the data and all those kinds of things.
All right. So I got eyebrows kind of raising up. Do we actually, yes, why don't you come up and see if we need to do anything additional?
Let me clarify. I'm not an attorney. If you guys are fine,
Chair Przanski, Senator Lithicum, don't ever give an attorney a blank check like that. Otherwise, the discussion that we were just having in the gallery was about if we receive a clear directive from this legislative committee about the form that the rulemaking should take on this, if it's the understanding of the shared legislative intent here that by rule there should be an understanding that those agreements are codified before any information is shared, we think we can get there. So that is our takeaway of what we're hearing from this committee.
Indeed. So with that caveat, with that legislative intent documented as part of the record, rulemaking has the freedom to build that into the construct.
Yep. Thank you.
All right, thank you for the clarification and putting that on the record as well. So any other discussion on the motion? Not seeing any objection to the motion. Not seeing any, it will pass. And Senator Wagner, this will be your bill to carry to the floor.
Be happy to. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll close that work session on House Bill 4082A. And we'll open up our last of our public hearings on House Bill 4095. Jana?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 4095 was heard in the House Judiciary Committee and passed out of that committee with a unanimous vote and was unanimous across the House floor. It deals with Rule 503 of the Oregon Evidence Code, which protects confidential communications between clients and their attorneys. This privilege extends to folks who are consulting an attorney for the purpose of obtaining legal services, but it's not clear as to whether that extends to communications between a lawyer referral service and a potential client. So House Bill 4095 extends that privilege to people who are consulting an attorney referral service with the view of obtaining legal advice.
All right, thank you. I have three individuals scheduled to give testimony: Amber Hollister, Eric McClendon, and then Mary Sophia. Want the three of you please come forward. And while they're getting situated, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony today on House Bill 4095? All right, so Amber, you going to take the lead?
Yes, thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Amber Hollister here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. I'm the Oregon State Bar's general counsel, and I'm here in support of House Bill 4095. As explained earlier, this bill would extend the attorney-client privilege found at OEC 503 to communications made between a client, a potential client, and a lawyer referral service. The impetus for this bill is to put individuals who need help finding a lawyer on the same playing field as people who already know lawyers and can talk directly to them. And so what we find at the Oregon State Bar is that when individuals contact our lawyer referral service, they will often want to share information about the nature of their legal issue or problem, and that we need to hear that information so that we can match them with an appropriate attorney. The risk in that sharing at this point is that it's unclear whether that information is actually protected by privilege. I have with me here today the manager of our lawyer referral service at the Oregon State Bar, Eric McClendon, and he's going to speak briefly to the nature of that program. Eric.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Eric McClendon, and I am the Oregon State Bar's Referral and Information Services Manager. We administer four programs through my department to match up Oregonians to attorneys. We receive about 75,000 calls a year, 4,000 to 5,000 emails, and about 6,000 to 7,000 modest means program applications. So we have a high volume of Oregonians contacting us, and like Amber mentioned, they're providing us with very sensitive information about their legal situation, and often that's in writing too. So we do have people express concerns about sharing information with us, and if they refuse to provide us information on their legal situation or their contact information, then we're unable to provide them a referral through one of our programs. So really, not only is this a consumer protection, but this is also an access to justice issue for us. I'm just here to answer any specific questions you may have about our referral service, and I'll defer to Amber to explain more about the consumer protection aspects if you have any questions about that. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mary?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Mary Sophia here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Again, I'm sitting here in this chair both as a representative of my organization, but also as a practitioner who's practiced both family law and private and public defense. My organization believes that this is a common sense fix to the confidentiality statute. It really makes sense for consumers in Oregon who are going out to look for a lawyer, and obviously the first place they'll stop is the Oregon State Bar, to get an attorney or get a referral to an attorney, for them to be able to share information in confidence. Confidentiality is a core tenet of the relationship between a lawyer and a client, and a lawyer and a potential client. And I'm looking at Senator Bentz and Senator Prezansky, because I know that in your experience as lawyers, even the perception of a relationship with a client or a potential client, confidentiality should exist there. And so it really does make sense from my organization's standpoint. As a practitioner, I was actually a lawyer that was on the lawyer referral service list. And so it makes so much sense that a client coming my way in the past would be able to share confidential information without any type of risk to them. And so, again, we think this is common sense. Confidentiality truly is key when it comes to the practice of law, and it makes sense to codify that specifically for the lawyer referral service. Thank you so much.
Right. Thank you.
Chair Prezansky, if I could make one small clarification, I just wanted to clarify the scope and intent of the bill. Certainly, if you look at Section 1 sub D of the bill, you'll note that the scope and definition of lawyer referral service is intended to apply to circumstances where a service, an entity, makes recommendations as a part of its regular business for an individual to connect with a lawyer. This language is not intended to extend to government entities such as the Oregon Judicial Department that has court facilitators on staff that may encourage people to hire counsel, but they're certainly not as a part of their regular business giving out names of attorneys. So just for the record, I wanted to make that clarification.
Thank you for putting that on the record. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Eric, thank you very much for taking time out of your day as a practicing attorney. It's always great to have individuals that are within the bar here to give us that perspective that we so dearly need at times. So thank you, Chair. All right, with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 4095. I believe we have the paperwork, so we'll open a work session on House Bill 4095.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 4095 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 4095 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Bentz, will you be our carrier on 4085?
Sure. Happy to do so.
All right, so we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on, the work session on House Bill 4095. And that takes care of what we have for today. So before we adjourn, what's our Monday look like? We don't meet on Mondays. Excellent. Right. So enjoy the weekend, and we'll see you back here on Tuesday. With that, we're adjourned.